Daniel chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision, night, I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. First was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted up from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat you fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. The beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening, and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was as white like wool. This throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated. The books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words that the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was the one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed.
Now we come to the interpretation of the dream. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit. The visions passed through my mind disturbed. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. 4 great beasts, 4 kings, rise from the earth. The power of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will bless it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others, most terrifying, with iron teeth and bronze claws. The beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on his head and about the other horns that came up before the 3 of them fell. The horn that looked more imposing than the others, and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them, till the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the people of the Most High. Time came, they possessed the kingdom. Give me this explanation. the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom will appear on earth, different from all the other kingdoms, and will destroy the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The ten horns of ten kings will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier one. He will subdue three kings. To speak is the Most High, and the press is where people try to change the set times on the laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands, time, times, and half a time. The court will sit, power will take away, and destroy forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven be handed over to the Holy Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by these thoughts, and my fears turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself.
Thanks, Liam.
Great, thank you. There's a lot in this. I'm going to put my watch down there. I was editing hard earlier on because I had an awful lot, so hopefully we've managed to keep somewhat meaningfully to time, although you'll appreciate I'm not able to do go through every verse and do everything in great detail. There's just so much in here. It's been a long time since we've had a coronation in our country. We're celebrating 60 years, I think it is, of when the Queen was crowned. 70, thank you, yes. Just doing some maths in my head. It might be a long time, or it might be a while, till we have the next one. And a new monarch and all of the associated coronations and everything that goes with it is perhaps a once-in-a-lifetime thing for us to see. It's a big deal with all of the ceremony and the clothing and the music and everything that happens. But an earthly coronation is tiny, in its significance compared to what we're seeing here. It's minuscule compared to what we see here in Daniel's vision. Because what this shows is, if I can put it this way, a coronation going on in heaven, which isn't just a once in a lifetime or once in a thousand years or once in a millennium. It's once in eternity, this event. And we get a glimpse of it, and we get to see a little bit about what is going on. It's hugely significant for God's plan for his people and for our world. Our current series is called Living Faithfully in a Strange New World. And as Phil's already alluded, we take a little bit of a turn this week. The first six chapters of the book of Daniel are primarily historic. We have accounts of what happened, and we can look at specific historical details, tie it all up, match it all up, and we see Daniel living in exile in Babylon, being faced with difficulties and challenges, being faced with tough times. But in that exile, we see him living faithfully. We see him living a life that is faithful to the one true God. And here things change, because the latter six chapters in the book of Daniel are prophetic. You have all kinds of coming up different visions and prophecies. So we're switching here from a physical world around Daniel, and in a sense around us, the physical world that we're familiar with, a world where we see physical battles, physical troubles, physical difficulties, a world with human powers and human difficulties and human challenges and human troubles. And we're shown instead a glimpse of an unseen spiritual world. It's just as real, but we're not always aware of it. A world that is always there, a spiritual world with spiritual powers, with spiritual battles, with spiritual troubles. Daniel has heard and interpreted the dreams of two kings, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. And now Daniel has a dream and a vision of his own. And we read in verse 15 that he's troubled. He's disturbed. Time-wise, this book of Daniel is not strictly chronological. We've actually gone back a little bit in time here. We've gone back to the first year of the reign of King Belshazzar, which happened before the events of the last two Sundays. So we've gone back a little bit in time, back to around 550 BC, And we can age it and time it pretty well because it is that first year of the reign of King Belshazzar, so we know when it happened. So this is 50 years into the exile. Daniel's in his late 60s. Daniel had held high office in the kingdom under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar. He had a tremendously powerful position. And now that Belshazzar was on the throne, Daniel is going to be marginalized for 20 years or so. And both he and the people of God are going to face a pretty bleak period. Daniel was not called back to the king until the end of his reign. If you remember, he was called back. He was remembered. He was called back to see the king, to see Belshazzar, to interpret the writing on the wall. But that is not going to happen for 20-odd years. And while Daniel is going through this difficult period, he and the people of God at the time and us, when we're facing difficulties, needed to look up and needed to be reminded and needed to understand what was really going on in the spiritual world, what was really going on in eternity, what was really going on in God's plan, and not only be looking at the world around him. And so this vision is given to Daniel as an encouragement for these hard years that he's going to face. This tough time. Remember, he's in an exile in a foreign land. This new king, Belshazzar, we can see from chapter 5 and verse 23 that we looked at recently. This Belshazzar set himself up against the God of heaven. And as someone who's trying to live faithfully for the God of heaven, Daniel's going to go through a tough time. He needs hope. He needs something to encourage him. And actually, the prophecy that we see here in Daniel has similarities in a way to what we see at the end of the Bible in Revelation, another book of prophecy, again written for similar reasons. It was written to comfort and to encourage Christians who were experiencing tremendous persecution at the hand of an emperor. When a human power is persecuting you, when a human power is making life hard, it's important to remember the bigger picture, that there is a power greater than this human power, that there is a power greater than the king or the emperor who may be persecuting you, and that's what Daniel sees here. And we need it. We're living in a world that doesn't recognize God. We're living in a world that doesn't acknowledge him. We're living in a world that doesn't honor Jesus, but rejects him and tries to oppose him. And we need sometimes that comfort and that encouragement that what we see around us is not all there is, that what we see around us is not the full power of the world and all that there is. God is greater, and we need that encouragement as well. So this chapter deals with a big picture. It kind of covers the entire sweep of human history, in a sense. We have this sort of, we're zoomed right out, and we just see events that have happened and events that have not yet happened. And actually, as we'll see, some events that have happened between Daniel's vision and now. So we get that huge kind of sweep of history. Ron and Jasmine read, read that part that says later on in the passage, we start to get the interpretation. I'm not going to leave all of the interpretation to the end, because otherwise we're going to have to do a lot of work at the end. So I'm going to try and cover it a little bit as we go through and hope make it a little bit more digestible. So let's kind of jump in, shall we? First point, human history is awful. I didn't really like history at school. I don't know if it was just the teacher. I don't know if it was just the particular topics that we studied. I did lots about the Industrial Revolution, the repeal of the Corn Laws, the potato famine. I mean, it was dull, dull, dull. I didn't like history. It was not the most fun. Apologies to those who do like history. And as many of you will know, our eldest daughter did go into a history degree, and I know there are people here who did. But actually, I'm more interested in history now than I was then, perhaps because history teaches us a lot about human nature. Verse 1 tells us that Daniel had a dream and visions, and he wrote it down. This is Daniel trying to write down what he saw. Daniel believed that there was supernatural meaning in this vision. He was revealed to him by God. And what was this vision? Four winds of heaven churning up the great sea, the Mediterranean. Four great beasts coming out of the sea. The first beast, like a lion, with wings of eagle. The wings were torn off, and the beast was lifted so that it stands like a human being. And the mind of a human, or the heart of a human, was given to it. The four beasts represent four kingdoms. We know that from the interpretation later on, or earthly powers. This first beast of a lion represents Babylon. The eagle's wings may refer to the swiftness with which Babylon conquered other countries and other lands and other nations. The plucking of the wings, the removal of the wings, may refer to that period where Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, his insanity, where he was really humbled from being that great king to one who was living like an animal. And then when the beast is stood on its back legs, as it were, on two legs and given the mind of a human, I think we can interpret that's referring to the restoration and the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar, becoming far more like a human than like a man. The second beast is like a bear, raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth and told, "Get up and eat your fill of flesh." There are some differences about the interpretation of this. Some suggest that the second beast is the Medes, the empire of the Medes, and that the third beast is the empire of the Persians. And some think that this second beast represents combined the empire of the Medes and the Persians. And I think I favor the latter. The Medes and the Persians are referred to together in much of what we read, particularly in this book of Daniel. Although, as I say, there are some differences. So this bear represents the Medo-Persian Empire that followed on from the Babylonian Empire. The third beast is like a leopard with four wings on its back, like those of a bird. It had four heads and was given authority to rule. Yeah, the wings could signify swiftness, and the four heads could signify an aspect of universality here or of knowledge. This third beast is representative of the Greek Empire that followed on again from the Medo-Persians. But do notice that these beasts are given authority to rule. We're told that this beast was given authority to rule. There is no rule or power that is wielded by any person or any empire or any king that is not given by God. These beasts do not take power, or they may fight each other, but God is the one who gives the authority. God is supremely in charge and allows leaders and empires to rise and fall. He gives power for a time. And then the fourth beast, which is described as terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Again, some differences of interpretation of what the fourth beast may represent. Some commentators say the fourth beast represents Rome. There are references to iron, and also drawing a comparison to that picture of a statue that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2. Others think differently. Reasons being that the fourth beast is not likened to any earthly animal. The other three were. The fourth beast is not. It's not compared to an earthly animal. It's not said it was like the others, a lion, a bear, a leopard. This was different. This is not compared to an earthly animal. There's no earthly reference to it. We are explicitly told that it is different from the former beasts. And I think what it's, perhaps the best way to interpret this is for us to remember that some powers that oppose God and his people are physical, empires, nations. And some of the powers that oppose God and his people are ideological. The fourth beast could be an ideal, a belief system, a postmodern worldview, a godless worldview. Opposition is not always physical. Sometimes it is that spiritual opposition. Or it could simply be a representation of future evil powers that the world will see. Rome was not the last evil power that the world saw. So this could be more of a general representation of the world powers. These empires were old. Maybe we know what happened with some of these old empires. Maybe we don't. I spent a fairly sad period of time looking at some people whose names may be more familiar with us. Joseph Stalin, dictator of the Soviet Union from 1922, 100 years ago, till his death in 53. As a young man, he was a robber and an assassin. For almost 30 years, he reigned with terror and violence in the Soviet Union. Under his rule, over 20 million people died, many through starvation. He once said, "One death is a tragedy, a million deaths is simply a statistic." Adolf Hitler, we know, Chancellor of Germany from 1933 to 45 and Führer of the Nazi Party. His actions resulted in the death of over 50 million people. Mao Zedong, or Chairman Mao, was a dictator of China from 43 to 76. His actions killed between 40 and 70 million people through forced labor, executions, and starvation. Idi Amin declared himself president of Uganda, and as dictator, he killed and tortured 500,000 people between 71 and 79. That's not that long ago. None of these are that long ago. Pol Pot was the leader of the Cambodian revolutionary group, the Khmer Rouge. He believed in destroying the Cambodian civilization in order to start a new regime and usher in a new age. From 76 to 79, his policies led to the death of around 2 million people, which was a quarter of his population. Saddam Hussein, responsible for the death of 2 million. Kim Jong-sung, the dictator of North Korea from 48 to 72, started the war that resulted in the death of millions. His son, Kim Jong-il, continued his legacy. And Kim Jong-un is now carrying out the same. Millions have died of famine, starvation, execution. North Korea has suffered almost 70 years and still is. And persecuting, actively persecuting God's church, God's people. The church in North Korea under specific persecution. 50 to 70,000 believers are estimated to be held in prison camps, where they are abused, mistreated, tortured, and executed. These beasts, Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, others, were horrific, but the evil that pervades the world is still happening. Spending time Googling the world's worst people is not something I'd recommend you do. You know, these were all in the last 100 years, and some of them are still alive, and some of them are still in power today. There have been centuries, there have been millennia of evil leaders, of evil people. Lord Acton wrote a well-known words in 1887, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." That bit we probably know. The last bit of the quote maybe we don't know. Great men are almost always bad men. Evil people have power, but it's limited. It's limited to a certain geography or region, and it's limited to a certain time. God's power, in contrast, is not limited. It's for good. And it's not limited to a particular time, and it's not limited to a particular region. God does not direct the evil in this world. But sadly, because we live in a fallen world, evil is there. But nothing is outside of his sovereignty. Let's move on from the awfulness of human history. The second point, verses 9 to 14, the king is in heaven. You know, music in films is maybe something we don't notice that much, but it's very kind of emotive, you know, the kind of the tension building in a particular film. Maybe the music is there and it's adding to the tension, and you're kind of on the edge of your seat, creating an atmosphere. And then suddenly, the music changes, and you have a completely different sense. You have a completely different atmosphere. And something like that happens here. Verse 8, we have a beast speaking boastfully. And suddenly we find ourselves in a totally different place in verse 9. "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." We find ourselves in a throne room so different from where we just were. And maybe you've seen throne rooms. Maybe you've gone on visits of castles or palaces and you've seen throne rooms. I was going to put a picture up, and then I thought, well, no, don't. Because whatever picture I put up is just so far short of anything that may be going on in heaven. But the phrase of a throne room probably does bring some of those images to mind. But be assured, whatever you can think of, whatever you've seen, whatever you can picture, is way far short of this. The throne room of heaven. And verse 9 is not happening as a response to verse 8. This is not chronological. The throne is not being set up in response to the rise of evil. No. Rather, as evil nations come and go, we see who's really in charge. We see what's really going on. We get that perspective of the throne room of heaven with the Ancient of Days sitting on his throne. The Ancient of Days, God the Father, not old, not weak with age, but one who has existed from eternity and will exist to eternity, one who is from everlasting to everlasting. And God the Father is not, I almost don't want to say it, he's not panicking. He's sat on his throne. He's not running around heaven, wondering how he should react to the evil that's going on in the world. He sat sovereign on his throne, under control. And what do we see of his throne? Flaming with fire and a river of fire flowing, coming out from before him. Fire has been an indication of God's presence throughout the Old Testament. The burning bush where God met with Moses. The pillar of fire that led the people of Israel when they were in the wilderness. But fire also speaks of judgment. God is on his throne. And we see here a glimpse of and a reference to judgment, of the wrath of God. The anger of God at this evil poured out on those who oppose him. But not, fire is hot, but this is not just a hot anger. No, we read that there was a court was seated and that books were opened. This is measured. The court was seated, the books were opened, and there were countless servants attending him. Daniel is attempting, as has already been mentioned, to write down the number he saw in his vision. Remember, this was a vision that Daniel saw, and then he tries to write down what it was that he saw. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. Now, if you remember when we were first introduced to Daniel, he's a very intelligent man. There was none could be found like him in terms of the learning and knowledge. And he's writing down here that there are tens of millions stood before the king, and there are thousands upon thousands of servants serving. And in that context, when we see that power that God has, the books are opened, the court is in session, and immediately the fourth beast is dealt with, slain and thrown into the fire. And you could almost skip over it, because we don't have this big scene. We don't have this big kind of Hollywood blockbuster type fight where we're wondering who's going to win. And there's the to-ing and fro-ing that we're so familiar with. That's not what we have. That's not what we see here. No power can stand before God. God has power that is so far above these beasts that whenever he chooses to, he acts swiftly. And that fourth beast is destroyed. The other beasts are stripped of their authority. Again, God has given it, and now God takes it. He takes their authority, but they are allowed to live for a while. And then we see on verse 13 and 14, one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. One like a son of man, one who is human, one who was born to human parents. And that phrase, that title, son of man, is one that Jesus took and used to refer to himself many times in his earthly ministry, taken, we presume, directly from this passage in Daniel. But he doesn't come from heaven to earth. He approaches the Ancient of Days, and he's led into his presence. It's amazing that anyone who is a son of man, anyone who is human, could go into the presence of God and survive and live. Only God would do that. Only one who is pure, completely sinless and pure. And so we see and we know that this must be Jesus. This can only be Jesus. One who is man and God going into the presence of the Ancient of Days, into the presence of God the Father, into heaven's throne room. So what is Daniel seeing? Well, this is not yet Jesus' second coming. This is not Jesus coming from heaven to earth. This is Jesus going into heaven. So this is his ascension. I think all the commentators seem to agree this is his return to heaven after his resurrection. Now remember, when Daniel had his vision, this had not yet happened. Oh, someone's woken up. This son of, he returns from heaven to heaven after his resurrection. He comes to earth, he dies, he's risen, and then he ascends back to heaven. And this is what we're seeing here. When he's given authority and glory and sovereign power, and all nations and all peoples will worship him. It is, if I can put it that way, the coronation of Jesus. We don't see a crown, but he's made king. He's given all power. He's given all authority. And him as king and his kingdom will never be destroyed. Human kings come and go, but Jesus' kingdom will be eternal. No one will conquer Jesus' kingdom. And as I said, Daniel saw this happening as prophetic, something in the future. But now in 2022, we look back at this as history. Jesus has come. He has died. He has been raised again. He has ascended. And he is now the King, seated in glory. This is now history. But there is a now happened and a now not yet aspect to Jesus' kingdom. Jesus is king, but all nations are not yet worshipping him. Not yet. And so we move on to the last of my 3 points. Jesus' kingdom will come. But we can see that the journey may not be easy. This was a vision for Daniel. This was not a study of a text. This was vivid. This was tangible for him. He was scared. He was disturbed. He was upset. He wants to know what it means. And the explanation that he's given comes in two parts. First, we get an overview in verses 17, 18, and then we get more detail in verses 19 to 27. So to begin with, the overview. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth. But the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. And we've covered some of this interpretation already about the beasts and the kings. This might be difficult for us. It's a complicated passage. I've spent longer looking at it, so maybe have a bit more of an advantage, as it were. But it is. It's difficult. It's a difficult passage. And maybe this is the first time we've encountered such prophecy and such texts in the Bible. It may be confusing. There's so much imagery. But if we remember one thing, then remember this. Opposition will come, but Jesus will bring in his kingdom. That's essentially what we are to remember. Opposition will come, but Jesus will bring in his kingdom. And when he does, his people will dwell in his kingdom with him for eternity. And that was an encouragement for Daniel, hopefully. And that's why Daniel was given this vision, as a great encouragement, telling him that while things can be hard, look up. Look at what God's doing. Look at who's in charge. Look at who's running the universe. And look at what God's plan is ultimately for his people. The holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. And if you're a believer today, that includes you. We will receive the kingdom and possess it forever. We will be in that new kingdom with Jesus as our king. Daniel was alarmed and dismayed. Daniel knows how bad the Babylonian kings were. And this vision tells him that things are going to get worse. And there's a lot more detailed explanation in the remaining verses from 19 to 27. Focuses more on the fourth beast with the 10 horns. This fourth beast was unlike the others. Unparalleled in its evil, fallen worldly power at its absolute worst. And as I said earlier, I went back 100 years and picked a few people, but through history, we know that there will be, or there have been, so many evil people, and that God's church will be opposed. Opposed from the devil, and opposed from what the Bible refers to as an antichrist. We will be opposed. There will be those who stand against Jesus. The fourth beast will, as verse 25 tells us, speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and the laws. This beast stands opposed to God and his people and will try to change, but wasn't able to, isn't able to. No other authority, no other power can stand before God. The court will sit, his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. At his resurrection, at his ascension, Jesus was crowned as king. He's now sat on his eternal throne. His kingdom has not yet come, not fully, but there can be no doubt that it will. Opposition and evil will continue to happen. And when Jesus returns, that will all end. The book's written. The ending is a foregone conclusion. This will happen. Jesus will bring in his kingdom. And that is either the best news ever or the worst news ever. Because for those of us who are his children, his people, this is the best news ever. We get a new heaven and a new earth. We get life as it was supposed to be, life as God intended it to be. We get to live in the wonder of a world where there is no evil, where there is no sin, where there is no pain, where there is only joy and love and joy and wonder and our Savior. Life as it was meant to be. But see how God deals with those who oppose him. The beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into a blazing fire. God's judgment on those who oppose him will be swift and will be awful and will be terrible. You cannot stand before a holy God without the cover and the protection and the forgiveness found in Jesus. And if you're not his follower today, this is giving us a glimpse of what will happen. Turn to him while you still can. We're going to sing as we close a song, Crown Him with Many Crowns. We cannot crown Jesus. He's crowned. This song isn't saying we can do something to somehow add to his crowns. That's not what it's saying, I don't think. I think what it's saying is considering the different aspects of Jesus' kingship, that he is the Lamb on his throne, he is the Lord of life, the Lord of love, the Lord of peace, the Lord of eternity, and we're to recognize him as such and to crown him in our lives as such. So let's use these words, shall we, to praise and worship.